Today, from contestant to producer, how reality TV can change your life. And in comment, Gabby Hinsliff on why Theresa May just won't give up. Love Island is a cultural phenomenon. Last year, the finale pulled in 3.6 million viewers overnight. I'm a big Love Island fan. I watched almost every single episode of 2018. But just how much of Love Island is for real?
They stick us in these like convertible like Jeep Cherokee things and like they're like, okay, everyone, like act really like fun, like we drive
you have
away.
To, like stand up and oh, you're yeah. all glistening in
okay,
the sun.
Let me tell you that we literally drive to the bottom of the driveway and then we get out and get in a minibus.
But what happens to the contestants when it ends? Earlier this month, a former contestant, Mike Thelasitis, took his own life at the age of 26. His death has brought up questions about the impact of being on reality TV. Johnny Mitchell was Mike's friend and a contestant on the same series.
Mike saw the show as like kind of like a new beginning. So before the show, Mike did like some semi-pro football and he used to work in DPD. He used to like be a delivery guy. And so, you know, even though it made his life better and a lot more enjoyable, it increased the pressure and it increased his yearning to prove himself. Like he didn't want to be the one to sort of like have to go back to a normal job.
And it's not only those in front of the camera who struggle with being part of reality television.
In any good story structure that's crafted correctly, you have protagonists and you have villains. And so we were behind the scenes trying to write a television show and they were sort of trying to write their futures and that became like an all-out war.
We hear from Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, whose series Unreal is based on her experience of working on the US reality show The Bachelor. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackson. Today in Focus, what's the reality of reality TV?
So now you're kind of selling yourself to the execs, to the show, to get cast.
Yeah.
Are they selling the show back to you?
Yes, they are. And the way that they can paint a picture of what the lifestyle is going to be like after is very persuasive. And it's kind of like a lot to do with the reason why I signed up for it. So I knew I wasn't going to be like mega famous. I knew I wasn't going to be on TV in 10 years time. But I thought, you know what? I go on a show like this. It's going to be a fun year. I just thought it's going to be cool.
This is Johnny Mitchell. In 2017, he was 26 and travelling the world. He'd built a flashy Instagram account with a couple of thousand followers, and that's where the producers of Love Island found him. After a bit of persuasion, he was cast to be in the series.
You get referred to a psych. I was away at the time. I did my psych over Skype. I was probably speaking to psych for the best part 10-15 minutes. I don't know other people's experience. Maybe she spoke to me and she was convinced after 15 minutes that I wasn't going to be any issues. But the questions that I was asked were very sort of generic. I would have thought I asked about history of mental health, like have I ever had suicidal thoughts. But of course you got to bear in mind if I was like 18-19 years old and I was like about to go on one of the biggest shows, I'm going to lie through my teeth to the psychologist. I was in Budapest and I went on some massive health thing and like obviously while I'm out there I'm like trying to get in shape and I'm like looking at myself and I'm looking at the guys on TV like while I'm watching it back and I'm thinking fucking hell. I was calling one of the producers. This was like 2-3 phone calls and I was like, my God, like I don't think that I'm right for this. Like I'm going to get laughed at. I end up going on TV.
Were you worrying about your body mainly?
Worrying about my body. Because like I thought personality wise, I thought I'm just kind of like, I get on with everyone and that's what everyone thinks when they go on there, you know? But obviously the show has a different agenda. What I got back was, Johnny, you're worrying over nothing. Like, don't worry about it. Like, trust me, we only pick the best looking people in the country for this show. Like, literally. And I knew he was being like, look, you're going to be famous. Like, you're never going to be able to walk down the road again without someone, you know, not recognizing you. And it does work. It kind of sells it. But I did think that if anyone else was in that position and they were really sort of like expressing concerns about how they felt about themselves going on show, that there's 5%, maybe less, of them being like, you know, talking to a psychologist, have you considered like the negatives of the show? And then the other 95% is just like, it's going to be great. You're going to be brilliant. Imagine your life after.
So after a medical examination, an STI test, and another short meeting with a psychologist, he finally heads to the island of Mallorca, where a huge TV set surrounds a villa, about to be full of young hopefuls looking for love or fame. First, they put him into lockdown, meaning they took his phone and put him in a hotel with a minder. after 10 days, he was sent into the show.
Hello, girls. How are you?
Stunners.
Okay, Johnny, you are darling.
Nice to meet you.
Next day, the producers pull you out and they're like, okay, so who do you like? And I was like, well, I don't even know. It's like, I'm just literally half scared about pissing everyone off because, like, everyone's sort of, like, really happy in their little thing. And I'm like, no, you've got to say someone. So I said Amber. And I don't even know why I said Amber, but it was just kind of like I was pulling names out of a hat. About halfway through the next day, like, Johnny, so you need to have this conversation with Amber. You need to tell her you like her. And I was just like, what? So I did it, regrettably. And then they didn't get what they needed, so they made me do it again. And then they made me do it again.
Yeah, okay, you know I fancy her. Like, it's not a big fucking... Yeah. But, I mean...
And, like, you are my type. If you'd have come...
And then after all this conversation stuff with Amber, I just thought, you know what, I can't do this. So I just walked out the front, and then I just said, I'm going. And then they were like, we're really disappointed in you, Johnny. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, we all just kind of thought you were going to do really well, and we're kind of just really disappointed that, you know, you're taking the easy way out with it. And, like, it's that kind of stuff. The message was being put across. He's like, do you not think it's kind of, like, more embarrassing to just walk out? And then I was like, well, I'm going. And he said, well, we can't just let you go. They drug it out for so much. And he's like, look, just sleep on it. And I slept on it. So I just thought, okay, I'm past, like, the first hurdle. I can probably do my best to get through it. Like, it's a very stressful environment. It makes it look like we're busy all day, every day, but you're not. You know, you spend 90% of the day just sitting around wondering what's going to happen next.
Any point during, did you get any psychological help?
So they have a psychologist, the same one, that's kind of like out there for the entire duration of the show. Now, she's not just there for the contestants. She's also there for all of the crew. But the process to actually get to speak to her is quite lengthy, yeah.
Did you ask to speak to her?
Yeah, I did. I did at one point towards the end. There was one particular thing that they did in one of the challenges, and it really wound me up, and I just decided that I'd had enough. Oh, this is how ruthless they can be. I don't know if you remember, there was a challenge where it was kind of like the strip pole dancing one, and like they do, you know, you have to go around the pole and then you have to read a statistic out from the public or something like that they put on Twitter.
In today's challenge, the Islanders will find out what you lot at home have been saying about them on Twitter.
Most of it's like, do you think Marcel is real about Gabby? Or something like that, you know, stuff to do with the show. And then my one, even after they knew the sort of like problems I'd had with my self-confidence about my body before I went on, the statistic that they gave me was what percentage of the British public thinks Johnny's good looking. And it was something like 12%. And like, whatever, like, I'm a big enough person, so it didn't bother me. Like, at the time, like, I had a smile on my face and I just sort of like smiled it out. But then as soon as I got back, I thought like, these sons of bitches are literally just trying to make me have a breakdown or something. Like, they're really trying to get to me. And I'd really voice my opinion that I had just kind of, like, had enough with these guys. I was like, you guys are just taking it too far. So I got to speak to the psych, and they basically put you in the beach diary room, whatever. And I think then she came in, and it was just, like, a very brief chat. And then the execs came in, and I just told them that what they were doing was completely out of order, and they apologised. They said, you know, how do you feel about going back in? And I said, if this sort of thing continues, then I'm not just going to... this isn't just going to be like an internal thing. I'm going to make a point of making this an issue outside. And then the next day, I got booted out.
If anybody gave resistance and they weren't giving good TV, they were out. You're basically working with non-consensual actors trying to write a television show.
Sarah Gertrude Shapiro is the writer and creator of the award-winning drama Unreal, based on her 3 years producing on the US reality TV series The Bachelor, another show about finding true love in front of a barrage of constantly watching cameras. She started working on the show in 2003.
And I was like a radical lesbian separatist living in almost like an art commune. So my friends and I had sort of looked at it as the fourth coming of the apocalypse.
Just describe what The Bachelor is, like a little summary.
Oh my God, The Bachelor. Like, I guess it's a competition where 25 women compete for the love of one very eligible, apparently eligible man. And in the end, one of them gets a proposal.
And they kind of like swan around in gardens of blossom. And
yeah.
So you're a producer on this show. Do you remember the first time you saw something really manipulative and thought, that's bad?
I think it was, you know, for me, there were a couple moments that really stood out. You know, it was really once it got to be very clear to me that we were in the casting process, like selecting girls who were pretty unstable. And I think that... because part of my job was to have close relationships with them and really befriend them so that they would trust me. It became challenging to me, I think, morally, to be doing that with people who I knew were just sort of not okay.
What, in what way, selecting girls who were unstable?
Inevitably, it draws people that are a little bit bombastic. And the truth is that characters need to be big. When you think about writing a drama, you don't want people that know how to get along with each other. You want people who don't know how to get along with each other. And you want people who are narcissistic and combative.
What sort of things did you find yourself doing for the right shot?
One thing that I found is a really good way to get people to cry was to actually make myself cry. And because I had no feelings about anything that was going on, and I had become pretty dead inside, a way that I found to cry was to actually get jalapenos from craft service, put them in my pocket, and then rub my eyes. What I really felt is that part of what was happening to the producers behind the scenes is that we were sort of becoming dead inside and we were becoming more and more cynical. And so I feel like that all coincided with the people at home becoming more and more bloodthirsty as these people exploited themselves and we sort of hated them for doing it but couldn't look away.
And how much of the women in lockdown, as it were, like cut off from the real world?
It was really a big part of the show to have the women completely sequestered. So they didn't have access to phones or magazines or music or anything except each other, which pretty much in and of itself would drive somebody crazy. And I think that was something that we knew.
Did people ever try and leave the show?
Yeah, we definitely had people walk off. I have chased people. I have chased people and You've almost physically them. Dragged them back.
Oh my God. Yes. When you say almost physically.
Yeah.
Expand.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I don't think I ever like laid hands on anybody and dragged them up a driveway, but it was definitely, we had runners. We had people who would just start running and sort of not realizing that they didn't have their cell phones or wallets or any way to get anywhere. People often want to leave.
Somebody get Chris.
This season, The Bachelor jumped ship.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. He jumped the fence.
Colton! Colton!
We're out in the middle of nowhere. He is gone.
The thing that was a big part of making Unreal for me too was just the idea that these contestants come in, and I think as at our most cynical, the producers always felt like they knew what they signed up for and kind of fuck them, honestly. Mm. But what I walked away really feeling was that they were up against an unbeatable game, and that there is no way that, like, you know, a sales associate from Kansas can understand the power of, you know, 100-person producing and editing team.
So after 3 seasons, you left The Bachelor and you went on to make the TV drama Unreal, about a producer working on a show called Everlasting, a very Bachelor-esque show. Why did you create it?
It felt like an incredibly urgent story to me. I think there was a lot of sense, you know, some people were sort of like, it's your revenge. And it didn't actually feel like that to me. It felt like a story that really needed to be told. And honestly, after the election, it felt even more important, just to sort of further the conversation about what that kind of television does to us on the whole, and whether or not we still value like each human life. I don't know that as a culture, we really have been taking very good care of each other.
How much do you think shows like The Bachelor and Love Island, Celebrity Big Brother, Big Brother have kind of played a role in that part of culture? Devaluing human life, getting pleasure out of watching people fall.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's been an enormous detriment to the culture. The you know, there are shows that I can think of, like, you know, Project Runway, I feel like is on the whole like extremely positive. The Great British Bake Off is like a shining jewel, you know, of sort of civility, a land where things are right. But I think what you see very much with Trump is that we've learned to live in sound bites, and really just the biggest asshole in the room is the winner. I feel like on the whole, it's been a rough go in terms of what the legacy of this genre of television has done for us. I don't know. I think the audience has to change its appetite for the actual culture to change.
Sarah, thank you so much for talking to us.
You are so welcome. I'm glad you guys are talking about this.
In the penultimate week of Love Island 2017, Johnny was dumped from the island. The world he walked back into was very different to the one he left.
So I'd come out and I assumed I was going to be all right. Like, I didn't really think that I'd done anything wrong. And then to come out to the level of sort of hate that I did was extremely concerning for me.
What was that hate? How had the public perceived you?
They had just perceived me as like some kind of, like, people calling me like love rat, and I even got death threats at times. Like, I can remember Marcel coming out. I met up with him at the after show, at the final, and the first thing he did was come up to me and he went, "John, you got screwed." He's like, "I can't believe it." He's like, "You got completely screwed."
Did you kind of get jumped on by agents and...
Yeah. Yeah, I had, like, by the time I'd come off, I had, like, maybe four or five trying to get in touch with me, but I just weren't interested at this point. I was in such a shit place, really. And then when it wasn't going away anyway, I just thought I might as well just get involved, just embrace it. Same way as Mike did with the whole Muggy Mike thing. You've really got no choice other than to just embrace what's going on, because nothing you say is going to change anyone's opinion. Everyone thinks, you know, even if you say I wasn't even that bad, no one's going to believe you. No one cares.
In the show, Mike Thelassitis was a fellow contestant and friend of Johnny's. During the season, he got the not very flattering nickname Muggy Mike, down to his role in a fiery love triangle. Earlier this month, Mike took his own life.
So you kept in touch with Mike, didn't you, after the series?
Yeah, me and Mike, on the show, these are things that you don't see. On the actual show, Mike got quite a hard time. You know, he's a good-looking lad. He came in, a lot of people were threatened by him.
He caused a storm when he came in, didn't he?
He did. He caused a complete storm, and rightly so.
Why are you here?
Why are you here? Same reason. We're all here to have a laugh, no?
Yeah? Maybe some people want more?
I think everyone wants a bit more, don't they?
Me and Marcel... In particular, we took to Mike immediately. As soon as Mike came in, he had a hard time. They don't show on it as well, that because he was getting such a hard time by some of these other guys, he lost his temper and he got really aggressive and he kicked over like the fire pit, and like the producers had to like kind of like talk to him and try and calm him down. Now, in my opinion, that would have been a good stage to be like, right, actually, maybe this guy's not prepared to be on the show, maybe he should be speaking to the psych. But no, they just calmed him down and they stuck him in a room for the night on his own, and then the next morning it was fine.
Do you think we saw the best of Mike?
I think you saw the real Mike. Okay. how I would deal with situations. Mm-hmm. But I think it was all serious.
Like, you were very serious.
I know, but that's because that's what you guys showed.
What bits didn't we see of you?
The triangle was all serious stuff, so
yeah,
it was going to be, it wasn't fun for me to be in that triangle.
Okay.
But obviously me and Johnny had a really good bromance. I used to call him J-Bone in there. I don't know if you ever got that.
We never heard about J-Bone.
No, J-Bone.
Jeez, we didn't see anything by the sounds of things.
When I came off, Mike was already off, so he was like the first person I wanted to see. He was the only one that I wanted to see. We always kept in touch, always.
What was he like? Because obviously he had the nickname Muggy Mike, which is kind of like
stuck with him forever. Which is just something that should never have even sort of been implemented. It had no basis to it. Mike's, even outside, you know, you speak to any of his really close friends and family, he is such a loyal guy. When it comes to his friends and his family, he's so loyal. Even after not knowing Mike that long after the show, if I had problems, Mike would be very, very sort of like forthcoming with any sort of help. And he was just good. He was so funny. Like, one thing that people didn't see on the show is how funny he was. He's so quick-witted, so sharp. When the last time I saw him, and you know, he was talking to me about issues that he did have, it was something that I'd never heard from him before. Mike always kind of like had a very optimistic view of what he was going to be getting up to. And that's kind of the problems that come with Love Island. There is no sort of next series where the same cast come back. It's new people. So you almost do have to like find the next thing in order to stay in the industry. And I think it became, you know, stressful for him when the next series of Love Island came out. Obviously work naturally decreases.
There's new blood.
It has new blood, and it's hard to come to terms with for a lot of people. And yeah, obviously, if you're used to making a certain amount of money and then it ends instantly like that. I never heard anything about Mike's money problems. I never heard anything about he was in debt. I've heard things now about like tax bills and stuff, but it's so easy for that kind of thing to happen. You know, if you're making 10 grand a week for an entire year, and as far as you know, it's never going to end anytime soon, and then all of a sudden it ends and you're like, Jesus, I've got to pay like 35, 40 grand in tax. Or no, probably more than that if you're making 10 grand a week. Mm. He never spoke to me about, you know, he wasn't prepared for like, you know, saving up for tax or anything like that. But if that was the case, it's very understandable, and I can see how easy it is to get into in this kind of industry.
How has it been for you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the initial shock was the first couple of days, just speaking to everyone, very upsetting, obviously. I mean, I think that the sheer shock of it, and then leading on, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, I got more angry, to be honest with you, more angry than anything else. just after Mike's death, I had a call from one of the producers. The amount of times where I could have used someone's help after the show, especially immediately after the show that I was on, and no one reached out, and now someone had to die for them to just make some phone call just asking me if I needed counselling.
ITV have responded and they've said that they're going to improve care for contestants and psychologically, but also financially and on social media. What do you make of their response?
Obviously, I'm very happy that they're making positive steps in the right direction. Of course, I'm happy, but I think that they're addressing the wrong end of the problem. They're addressing the end once the damage has already been done, which is the wrong way to be tackling this situation. You need to be looking at the start of the issue, and that is informing people properly that actually the lifestyle isn't what you think it's going to be. I mean, they love to tell people, you know, you're going to be famous and life's going to be great. And that's because, you know, it does them favours. They've had so many applicants this year. They've broken records for it. When you get a kid, 19, 20 years old, whatever, sit down, they need to be put in a position where they are getting information in front of them, like statistics. Mm-hmm. Like, here's the chances of you getting more TV work after. Here's the chances of you being on the show longer than 3 days. Here's the chance of you getting abuse when you come off, getting trolled. Here's the chances of you receiving some kind of a mental health problem. Here's the chance of you contemplating suicide. Them sort of things need to be on there. Because if I was in a position where I had a good job and I knew that I probably couldn't get it back, and I went in there and they said, actually, John, as nice as it's going to be for a few months, there's probably an 85% chance that you are not going to get any work after a year and the money will just stop. So, and you're not going to get any more TV, and no one's going to care. And once a new cast come in, sorry, but there are concern now, not you. So consider that. If I was in that position and someone told me that, I wouldn't do it. Everyone says to us, you know, you guys know what you're getting yourselves into. There is no way in hell that Mike Thalassitis would have got himself into that show if he knew he was going to end up in such a dark place to end up doing something like this.
Suicide is obviously really complex, and there will be all sorts of reasons.
Of course, I'm not at any
Mike
point,
took his life. Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah, no, I'd never point the finger at the show and say you're to blame. But people close to Mike will know what he was dealing with, and you'll know how much of that is sort of off the back of this lifestyle.
Would you like to see it end?
I think there's a place for shows like Love Island. I've got no issue with Love Island, but things do need to change now in order for it to be a more beneficial show. People love watching it, that's fair enough, and I wouldn't want to see people go without a job. Like I've said before, you know, these Love Island bosses, they're not evil. They're not just sitting there thinking we're going to ruin these kids' lives. They're doing a job, but they just need to do it now that people are taking their own lives. It's a time for things to change, and they need to just see, actually, the system is a little bit broken. We need to tweak it. We need to make things better. And in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to cost them a lot to do it, and it could save lives.
Johnny, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers, guys.
If you or anyone you know needs support relating to issues covered in this podcast, please head to our programme page for details. Search for Today in Focus at The Guardian. In a statement, Love Island expressed its deepest sympathies to the family of Mike Thalassitis. It says its duty of care follows 3 key stages: pre-filming, filming and aftercare. It works with both an independent GP and a psychological consultant. The medical team also contacts each islander's GP to check they feel that the person is able to take part. It says medical and psychological care continues whilst the islanders are in the villa. Once the islander leaves the villa, they say they have a series of debrief meetings on location, including with the psychological consultant. After this, they are told how to access aftercare support, as well as information on seeking professional representation. They are also briefed and advised on their press coverage whilst in the villa. Following an independent review 6 months ago on its process, Love Island says the key focus going forward is to no longer be reliant on the islanders asking for support, but to proactively check with them on a regular basis. The Bachelor declined to comment. Next, what keeps her going? Gabby Hinsliff on Theresa May. Now, in the last few days, things have been looking rocky for Theresa May. Members of her own party are openly speaking out against her, and she still can't get the votes for her deal. With all of this strain, Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff asked why Theresa May is still hanging on in there.
Theresa May clings on in circumstances where other people would have thrown in the towel about 2 years ago. She has an astonishing ability to outlive predictions of her doom, and that's what we've seen this week. She's hanging on in there, insisting that somehow her deal isn't dead yet, even though it gives every impression of being dead, and failing really to indicate any other way forward. And that always makes people wonder, you know, what on earth drives her to this kind of intransigence? And I think there are personal reasons for that, and I think there are political reasons for that. She's not a flexible or imaginative politician. She's not the sort of person who you would expect to take a huge leap and produce some solution that nobody's ever thought of out of nowhere. And then there is the sort of fabled sense of duty. I think she genuinely does believe that the people voted for Brexit, therefore the people should get Brexit, because that's democracy. So that's what her deal offers. And therefore, I think she can't, you know, somehow make a mental leap beyond that, even if it, you know, it's now blindingly obvious to pretty much everyone that deal is not flying through Parliament, to put it mildly. We really are very, 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 very close to falling out of the EU without a deal at the moment. So it's understandable that at that point, the pressure on her gets much more intense. I mean, she's had, first of all, speculation about her being replaced, about a sort of cabinet coup, Sunday newspaper stories about how cabinet ministers were supposedly going to go to her on Monday morning and say, look, you're obviously, you know, you can't do this, so we need to replace you with someone else, a caretaker leader maybe, or Deputy David Lidington or Michael Gove or somebody who can get us through all this. And the humiliation of having to announce to Parliament that she doesn't have enough support to put her deal to a meaningful vote again, and that it's not, she hasn't sort of ruled out doing so if support magically materialises from somewhere, or if, as is more likely, a process of indicative votes in the Commons ends inconclusively. So the Commons is asked to say, well, what would you support instead? And it turns out that there isn't a clear emerging winner, then, and I think only then in those circumstances, could she go back and say, right, you don't know what you want. You know you don't want no deal and you don't want no Brexit. Since you can't come up with an alternative, my plan is the only game in town. And I think that's what she's hanging on for now. I think Theresa May has said before and meant that she will serve so long as she continues herself of use to the Conservative Party. Now, the snag there is that quite a lot of the Conservative Party considers she's gone beyond the point of being any use. Every Prime Minister wants to be able to choose their legacy. You know, Tony Blair didn't want his to be all about Iraq. David Cameron clearly doesn't want to go down only as the guy who held that stupid referendum. And Theresa May doesn't want to be remembered purely for Brexit. She does want to have a domestic legacy of some kind as a reformer. But the trouble is, as a PM, you don't really get to choose your legacy. I think we've gone past the point where even if Theresa May stayed on for longer, she could make any kind of meaningful contribution, really, in terms of domestic policy. Unfortunately, I think her legacy is being the person who had to somehow get us out of the Brexit mess. And it's only about whether she does that successfully or whether she goes down in flames and has to hand the wreckage on to someone else.
That's all for today. My thanks to Gabby Hinsliff, Johnny Mitchell and Sarah Gertrude Shapiro. Today's programme was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Brenna Daldorf. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you tomorrow.